The following program will make you want to grow things and experience new and wonderful dreams about your plants, garden, and garden design. Listener participation is always strongly advised. Good evening and welcome to Down the Garden Path with your host, Joanne Shaw, right here on Reality Radio 101. To contact Joanne live in the studio this evening, send her an email. Our email address is instudio101@gmail.com. And now, getting ready for her cruise this coming week, Joanne Shaw.
Thank you, Gary, and welcome everyone to Down the Garden Path here tonight, where we discuss down-to-earth tips and advice for your plants, gardens, and landscapes every week. And as a landscape designer, I always think it's important and possible to have a great garden that is low maintenance, and I love researching topics and guests that can help us with that. And I know you do too, because there's always lots to learn and lots to discuss. So that makes me very excited to introduce you to my guest this evening. Her name is Evelyn Haddon, and she's a national speaker and award-winning author of 4 garden books, including Beautiful No-Mow Yards, 2012, and Hellstrip Gardening, which I have this gorgeous book sitting in front of me right now, from 2014. Evelyn shares strategies to help people create and maintain comfortable, functional, nature-friendly landscapes with less or no lawn. She also founded the informational website LessLawn.com and is a founding member of the National Lawn Reform Coalition, as well as a partner at the lauded and provocative team blog Garden Rant. When she isn't gardening or writing about it, she devotes time to singing and songwriting, and she joins us live right now. Welcome, Evelyn.
Well, thank you, Joanne. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So I have to give you a bit of background. I don't know if you're familiar with the Garden Blogger Fling that happens.
Yes. I've been to one of them.
Oh, excellent. Well,
it was so fun.
Yes, it was. I've been to 2. And I went to the one that, so last year it was actually here in Toronto, so how could I miss that? That was the first one. And this year I went to Minnesota and so we were on, I think it was one of the first houses or first gardens to look at. And, you know, it was a lovely little backyard garden. There was a lot of us to try and fit into this lovely little backyard garden. But the front of the garden, it was actually a studio, so it was kind of in a commercial space and down in this little downtown area. Well, all of us gardeners were very impressed with the gardens that were between the sidewalk and the street, all along this little street. And someone said, "Oh, it's a Hellstrip garden." And everybody else went, "What's that?" And so we all discussed you. So I don't know if, you know, in July your ears were ringing, but we were all talking about, you know, the person, and I can't remember who it was that was raving about your book. And we were all raving about this garden and how tough these plants were and how they weren't on the tour. So these people didn't like prep them for us. This just happened to be there. So that got me on my journey of researching this topic. And I'm very excited to have you joining us tonight, because I think a lot of people, getting rid of our grass, especially this drought that we've had in Ontario this past summer, people are looking at other options. So.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. And I'm so pleased that you guys talked about health strips, and I think they are kind of new for a lot of people, but the Minneapolis area where I used to live when I was writing this book, I was actually living in the Minneapolis area, and they have a high concentration of health strip gardens compared to many spots in the country.
Oh, wow. Well, that's a neat coincidence. So what is, yeah, so let's go, so I kind of know the basic, but what's your description of health strip gardening?
Well, my broad way of defining a health strip garden would be any kind of fragment of land that's cut off from the rest of your yard by a road or by a sidewalk or even by a fence or the wall of a building. So I think all of these fragments share common characteristics and challenges. Even if they aren't in the front of your yard, they might be in the back alongside the alley, or they might be beside your driveway, or they might be under the eaves in a spot next to your garage or whatever. But they all are tough little spaces. And they're, another common thread is they're not really large enough or situated in good enough sites to have a lawn easily,
right,
or to use a lawn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or for a grass to grow. So I know I have one. I think we would classify it as that, in that I have a corner house. So, you know, and it's all the driveway's on one side of the corner, the front door's on the other. And I have a large island bed in that kind of corner that, you know, goes with the curve of the road. But from that bed to the curb, you know, where the snow and the salt and all that stuff happens all winter, that I've got about a 3-foot strip that, and then all summer gets burnt to a crisp.
So to me I look at that
and I've been really struggling with what to do, and so I'm really, again, another reason to be excited. So I think there's a lot of areas that take a lot of abuse, you know, winter and summer.
Yeah, they kind of are at the more extreme ends. They're drier or they're hotter or they're wetter or they're, you know, something about them is more extreme than maybe the rest of your yard. Maybe they're more compacted, so they're tougher.
Yeah, I think all of the above. Yeah. So what attracted you to this type of gardening?
Well, actually, Timber Press came to me with the idea for this book about health strip gardens, and but as soon as they did mention that they would like to see me write a book on this topic, I had tons of ideas because I had been noticing this kind of place ever since I started gardening. But this kind of space, either it jumps out because it's such a wasted area because there's nothing in it, or if you do happen to see one that's really thriving, then it jumps out because it's so unique and small and kind of a special, it has a specialness to it because it's so small, and maybe it's confined by pavement or maybe it's just unexpectedly tall compared to the lawn all around. But they're noticeable. In my mind, they were really spaces I'd been noticing for a long time.
Oh, that's neat. I have actually, you know, over the years designed a couple of them. But those homeowners were kind of brave and forward thinking, you know, and they were really the initiate. I have to say they were the initiator. You know, in one case particular that comes to mind is they had a very small little patch there at that boulevard, and they had the cable box and a phone box, you know, she just wanted to like make it. And sometimes I find those are tricky because people plant things that I think draw attention to the fact that you've got a cable box, you know.
Right, rather than distracting you from it. Or
they'll
plant something and not realize this box has a door that has to be opened periodically.
So
then they don't avoid that.
Yeah. So that was my challenge, and I think in that case I did succeed at it. I've driven past to kind of check on it, but so many other homeowners are hesitant, and even if I've done the front garden and I've gotten rid of the front lawn, everybody's afraid to do the boulevard, go to the next step, because it's quote unquote, you know, city property. And
And that really varies depending on where you are in the country, but it certainly, or in the, I should say in the continent when I'm talking to you, but it is sort of a semi-public space for sure. You might be in charge of most of it, or you might hardly even have any control over it. Maybe the city even comes out there and maintains trees or maintains a lawn out there. But either way, you have some responsibility, but not all the control. So it is harder to know what to do.
Right.
And if your neighborhood doesn't have other health strip gardens, it can be uncomfortable to be the pioneer.
Yes. But I think it's worthwhile.
But I'll tell you, these spread fast. Once you put a health strip garden in a neighborhood, they're so visible that other people can see them and examine them closely, and they get a lot of notice, and then they entice other people to try the same thing.
I agree. I think Toronto downtown does have quite a bit. Again, the size, and I think the concrete, surround, and the challenges in growing grass these days. So I think they are lucky enough. But in the suburbs where I am, it is fairly new, but I really want it to catch on. I really do.
Yeah. Well, those suburbs have other challenges. Mm-hmm. Runoff is often a tough thing for suburbs, or maybe you have large trees and you have a hard time figuring out what to plant underneath those, or, you have lots of lawn but very little privacy, and so you maybe want a screen or something. Mm-hmm. So there are other things that would prompt you to want some kind of a garden out along the street, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think those are some really good points, especially under trees where people really struggle with what to grow.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. Mm-hmm. And I think some people think, I couldn't do it in my zone. There's no plants that are that tough. But when I look through your book, when I read through your book, your book really covers a variety of states throughout the U.S. And so a variety of zones. So really, no matter where we are in North America, we should be able to do this, correct?
Oh, I think that's true. And as you know from your Zone 5 area, and then as you know from visiting the Minneapolis area, which is Zone 4, some parts of that are Zone 3B. And I've been up to Quebec City, and there are lots of great little tiny gardens up there in the health strips and the Vancouver area on the other coast. It just depends where you live. It sort of dictates what you might want to do that would succeed very well. If you're in California, for instance, you'd want to create a garden that's beautiful year-round if you could, but you might be okay with something that's dormant in the summer because that's the toughest time of year there, especially with the new realities of the droughts. But if you're in a place that's covered with snow at the ground level for much of the winter, like Minnesota is that way, and I assume Ontario has that same thing, then you'd think about that when you're designing, and you wouldn't plant things that are going to be maybe small shrubs that are easily crushed by large amounts of snow that are deposited by the plows, So you have to sort of think more about what would work here in this particular site and region.
Yeah. And the other thing that it's just hit me now, too, is what is very common is the strip between two driveways in the suburbs. Often people don't know what to do.
Oh, yeah.
There's like a 3 foot. You own half of it. Or sometimes one. I know in my case, I guess I technically own half of it. But my neighbor he kind of claimed it before I moved in. So he kind of looks after that. And we just have ornamental grasses that kind of separate our driveways. So he's done a good job of that. And then
those are great choices. Mm-hmm. And if you can get your neighbor to take care of it all, why not? And you can appreciate it.
Absolutely. So that's worked out well, except he needs to divide them. And he looks at me guiltily every year and he's like, he doesn't want to dig them out to divide them because they're gotten so big.
Tough to divide. Roots can grow deep and thick.
Yeah, they are. And it's getting full. So that is definitely a challenge. But yes, I lucked out from that way in that he looks after it. I guess and I have a lot of clients that want to do something, that want to claim that space and or two neighbors together that don't want to, they don't want to mow it and they don't want to plant anything huge because then the car doors hit it. So
I think that's a big challenge, and a low garden does make more sense right alongside the driveway like that, so then that restricts the plants. But again, And then when you have another person that you're dealing with as well so closely, then you restrict them even further because you want both people to be able to approve the plants.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you can still do it.
Excellent. Excellent. And where does one start? Like, what is your, once we've made the decision, is it the soil, or where do you feel it's the best place to start?
with these sites, I guess I think you're already ahead of most people, because I think most people would tend to want to run out and buy the plants right away. So they'd immediately say, well, what do you plant first? And you're asking a different question, so that shows that you understand there are all these challenges.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, 8 chapters of the Health Strip Gardening book were devoted, I think you might have, maybe you noticed.
Yes.
That they were, 8 of them were devoted to challenges.
Yeah.
So I think if you wanted to find a good way to assess your site, get an overview of really what are the challenges here in this particular location, and pay attention to the soil and whether it's compacted. It's also probably contaminated, so you think about that. If you think about if you have utilities running underneath the ground or overhead, think about that, and as well as the boxes that you were talking about that might be right on the site. You also want to think about there's going to be traffic, foot traffic, paw traffic. so you want to not lose sight of the fact that this is a in the public view and it's accessible to the public. So you'd maybe address it in different ways than you would a private garden. So you kind of have to consider all those issues and then think of your own priorities. What would you want out of this garden? Are you wanting it to be kind of a friendly welcome to your house? Are you wanting it to have a little bit of privacy screening? Are you wanting to extend your wildlife habitat, your pollinators and birds?
Yeah.
So those are things to just start with before you think about plants. And then you also want to think about access. If you are looking alongside the street and cars are going to be parked there and people are going to want to get from the street to the sidewalk or want to open their car doors, like you mentioned, and not have them run into a trunk of a shrub, then you need to think about those things when you plan. But it's like when you design, have you designed a single color garden before? It sort of restricts your...
Yes, yeah, I've tried to do like an all white garden or something, you know?
So what it does is, or it's the same as if you write poetry. It gives you a structure within which you have to be creative, but it can be easier in some ways because you're cutting out some of the many possibilities and you're narrowing it down. And so then you're choosing from the ones that are left. So it's, in a way, it makes it easier to make decisions about what will work here and what won't, and that might be helpful in a way if you're the kind of person who gets overwhelmed easily.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, that it does. It restricts you so you don't, because there are so many choices that it can overwhelm people. And I know it's fun that you mentioned that about me not going right to the plants, because I guess my little motto with my business has always been great landscapes start with a plan, right? And I just don't understand, because anybody who would like do a kitchen renovation would never get a sledgehammer out and say, this weekend we're going to start on the kitchen and sledgehammer their cupboards. But on the other hand, having a plan, they would absolutely have a plan first. But in the garden and outside, you know, it's completely different. They're like, they just get out the shovel, right? And they start digging.
It's so much play. It's so fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to keep ourselves restrained enough that we can plan when we're just wanting to be out there. I understand that.
Yeah.
But it will lead to a lot more fulfillment later and a lot less frustration. Planting the wrong thing is easier in a health strip. Planting a design without having good preparation is easier, and so then it's easier to fail.
And I think preparation, because they are such a tough area, preparation is key, you know, so the plants because, you know, I guess the plants are in the way, still the easy part, because you it's a smaller, typically probably a smaller area, so you're needing less quantity of plants than, let's say, you know, a whole front yard type of thing. So really, I think, I'm totally being selfish and thinking about that strip at my house, and I know how dry and how, you know, crabgrass and how tough that area is, that I think, and that's what's held me back, is because it's going to be a lot of work to make that good before I can plant. Like, the planting's the easy part, really.
Well, there's a slippery slope there.
No, is there? Okay.
Think about... yes, because if you think about many gardeners traditionally want to take a site and change it so that they can grow a wide variety of plants there, and kind of pampered plants, you know, the plants that you'd get at a garden center, mm-hmm. the plants that are really a little bit more unusual and unique, and for plant lovers, those are the things that they're growing the garden for. But out in a health strip, it's a little bit different, and you wouldn't necessarily want to spend a lot of money and time, you know, renovating the soil, doing things like digging it all up and fluffing it and adding a lot of nutrients to it or whatever. Really, what it'd be better to spend your effort on is just getting that soil covered, finding plants that work within the conditions that are already there, if you can, because given that it's semi-public and it probably has easements on it, it's likely that utility companies will one day have to come in there, maybe dig it up, maybe maybe a bus will run over it. If it's near the road, maybe somebody's tree will fall on it, maybe the car will crash into, I don't know. There's so many things. A horde of school children will trample it. Mm. You know, you have all these things that are going to threaten anything out there. So I'd say the preparation is also the mindset. Change the mindset to be, this out here is not a place for rare, unusual, or pampered plants. Mm-hmm. Or decorations, you know, really, really beautiful, expensive garden art or anything like that. It's a place for tough stuff that's going to maybe repair itself if it gets trampled, that that can really deal with compacted soil, so you don't have to be going out there later after the bulldozers have come, you know, or the snow plows and revamping that site yet again so those plants can live there.
Okay. So, wow. So that's great. You've given me permission to not have to go through all that work of making.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. You don't. And I mean, you can do a little bit of it, but it shouldn't be something that you spend a lot of resources on.
Okay.
Because of its nature.
Right. So the one that kind of stood out to me in the book is the cardboard method, or and also newspaper method that you mentioned. The website mentioned the newspaper, and then the book, I believe, mentioned the cardboard. So can you, I mean, I'm nervous to do that, but can you describe that for, I don't know. I don't know why I am. So why don't you describe that for us?
Okay. Well, I can see where if you haven't done it before, you might think, maybe there's a right way and a wrong way.
Yes.
But really, it's a little more fluid than that. I mean, I think it's all about killing the lawn while building the soil. And that's what I love about that method, is you're putting down materials that are not only going to smother the lawn, but they are also going to biodegrade and add soil, new, fresh topsoil, as they biodegrade, and then that lawn that they're going to kill is also going to add fresh topsoil. And that's the key in my mind, is that you're basically creating topsoil, and you're doing it more cheaply and easily than if you had to haul in a bunch of topsoil, you know, and it's very valuable. As gardeners know, topsoil is really valuable.
Yeah.
So that's what you're doing with that method. You can pile on, it all depends on your site, and many of my answers start with, it depends, because everybody's site and region are different, right?
Yeah.
So you can start with cardboard, or you can start with several layers of newspaper, and I would think about making the newspaper layers as thick as a piece of cardboard in your mind. Overlap all those paper products so that they cover the soil and don't allow any gaps for plants to grow up through, because dandelions, you know, taprooted plants like that, tough plants like that, creeping Charlie, will often be able to grow up through those layers, depending, again, on your site and how quickly things deteriorate. Then on top of the newspapers or cardboard, you would put probably a layer of wood chips would be the best out on, depending, again, how much wind your site is subject to. Those will hold it down a little more firmly.
Okay.
But you could also maybe use leaves if you put a low fence around them and keep them in place or wet them down or whatever.
Okay.
Really, you're just adding a layer of material on top that's going to be keeping that cardboard or newspaper pressed against the soil and maybe holding in some moisture and looking nicer than a layer of cardboard might for
yes.
the neighbors.
Yeah, so it can be mulch. It doesn't have to be soil. Like, we're not adding soil on top?
No, I wouldn't add soil on top. I think one of the main things I think is important is not to have bare soil out on those health strips because they're subject to so much runoff and wind erosion that the soil that's out there needs to be protected with a layer of plants, ideally a low layer of plants, or a layer of wood chips or some other kind of mulch. So I guess if you wanted to put down your layer of cardboard and then your layer of soil and then sow seeds right away of some kind of a cover crop, you can do that.
Okay.
And that might work really well. And then once the roots of the cover crop get down far enough to want to penetrate into what used to be the top of the soil, hopefully your cardboard will be biodegrading by then and the roots can just go down through it.
Okay. Now, would you need to keep the cardboard wet, like keep that mulch and cardboard wet?
Well, I think when you first put your cardboard or mulch down, start by cutting the grass really low and then watering really well.
Okay.
And then you've kind of prepared that soil.
Right. Okay.
And it's going to biodegrade quicker because it's got some moisture.
Mm-hmm.
So then you put your layer of paper and then you put your layer of mulch. And if you put your mulch down or your soil down right on top of your paper, then that'll hold it down. But if it's kind of a windy day, you might need to wet your paper as you put it down to keep it down. But that's mainly the only reason.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
And then if you sow seeds on top, of course, you'll want to keep them watered.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, it's almost better to not water the top. You know, if you've got a nice layer of mulch there and you're just waiting for everything to biodegrade, then, you know, seeds are going to be blowing around in the wind all the time, and watering that top is just going to start them germinating. So keep it dry up there so that they don't take root.
Yeah. No, that's a good point too. Yeah. You don't want to start a garden of weeds, right? On top of your garden.
Whole new problem.
Yeah, exactly.
But Joanne, I've also seen people use black plastic, and I know that many people don't like that, but if you are more pressed for time, you can even see it now when you're walking through Minneapolis or here in Boise. People will have a strip of thick black plastic held down with rock or brick or something in a neat way, and they'll just leave it there and let it prepare the site for them. So that's another way to do it, and it is a quicker way.
Right.
With the cardboard and the mulch, you may be looking at you might want to do it in the fall and wait over the winter and then plant that site again in the spring.
Okay.
Give it time to decompose.
Yeah. And I think for all of us here in the GTA, and that's a perfect thing to do. Like, this is a good time of year, right? The weather's still okay for us to do it.
Yeah.
And then that we let it just sit all winter And then in the spring, so things would start to be, you know, the cardboard would be decomposed by then. So then planting in that mulch in the spring, that's that sounds about right?
That's a good, yeah, that would be a good plan. And the one caveat there would be if you are doing this underneath mature trees, you want to make sure that they get their water. So you would definitely want to water before you smother, and you may even want to do a quarter to a half of the root zone at a time and leave the rest of it uncovered so that that tree can get its regular moisture.
Okay, yeah.
So the alternative would be to water underneath, you know, pull up the cardboard periodically and just have a hose soak the ground underneath there periodically if you need to, depending, again, on how big your tree is and whether you're in a drought and all that.
yeah, for sure. And that it brings a good point that I'll continue to emphasize on the show is the importance to give trees a good watering foundation before they head into winter.
Particularly those conifers.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. How has your weather been? Have you had the tough drought that we've had here in
I'm living in a summer dry climate, so I am just discovering. I've only been here a few years, but I'm just discovering what that means and pondering it. So it's hard to define what drought would be. We don't normally get rain during the summer, and we haven't had rain since July.
Okay.
So it's not too different. But on the other hand, the groundwater is definitely receding. People are using more water on lawns and things like that here in the basically what's the high desert. So I feel like the water is becoming less available in that way.
Right. And what about temperatures? Like, what are your average summer day temperatures this past summer?
We have it's a dry heat, as they say here, but it does get up in the 90s and 100s, and we have had more stretches in the hundreds than I remember when I was growing up here 30 years ago. We didn't have so many, but yeah, it's definitely been a hot summer.
Okay. Yeah. So then it's been like us too. So you've gone home.
Okay.
Have you by going back?
I have moved back home.
Oh,
yeah.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And now you're gardening. So have you enjoyed going from, you know, to a different climate to garden in? It's one thing to move there.
Fun.
Yeah.
I'm discovering new plants, you know, that I could not grow in Minnesota. I've been ordering from High Country Gardens catalog, which I received for years in Minnesota, but would just have to drool over because I could never find a spot that was dry enough for any of those plants. Now I'm filling my garden with them.
Oh, wonderful.
And I have two more months of gardening every year, two to three more, because the winters are so much shorter.
Yeah.
So that's exciting.
That's going to be exciting as well.
And exhausting.
yes.
We'll see how long I last.
So we do have one question from Teresa. She's wondering where she could get your books. She's from Ohio.
Oh, Teresa, you can go to the Timber Press website and buy it from the press, or you can go to Amazon and get it there. It's pretty widely available in bookstores.
Excellent. Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah,
I just
thanks
wanted
for
to,
asking.
Yeah, thank you, Teresa, for your question. I'm looking forward to the beautiful no-mow yards because I think, you know, I am seeing the change with a lot of clients that, you know, especially with the drought. I mean, it sounds like the weather you're describing is kind of typical for your area, Idaho, in Boise. But for here, we normally wouldn't, like, we have pretty much had a drought since May. And we've had for us, it's really been unusual. It has been hot and dry.
Yeah.
We've had some like rainstorms, like harsh rainstorms where because it's been so dry though, the rain has come really quick and really hard. And then it's just completely run off, right? It really hasn't made an impact in the gardens. So people have been.
That creates so many more challenges.
For sure. And
because now you have, you can't just turn to the plants that are drought tolerant. You've got to be careful to choose plants that would be okay if you got your regular weather, or they'd be okay if you got the drought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you choose plants that survive both? You have to turn more to generalists instead of specialists, and sort of narrows your choices.
For sure. But I think it just has also, I think you have much more options as far as plants go versus grass, because I think I get so much winter damage in my lawn that I spend so much time and effort in the spring fixing. And then the summer drought or the summer conditions, you know, we're always putting all this energy onto something as insignificant really as grass. So I think more and more, at least with plants and gardens, you have options, right?
Oh, yeah, you are so preaching to the choir here. This less lawn thing has, had me obsessed since I first started gardening. And to me, it just, less lawn means more life. That is the root of it all. And the thought that, with converting a lawn to some other kind of garden, you can get, not only more color if you're into that, but more texture. You can get aromas. You can get, the vertical layering of the plants, mm-hmm. so you can pack way more in there if mm-hmm. you're plant obsessed, and then you get the wildlife, which is one of the main reasons that I garden, and then not only that, but you have a landscape that changes through the year, mm-hmm. so it might be different in different seasons, mm-hmm. which is so much more interesting,
mm-hmm. yeah.
And as if all that weren't enough, then you have the whole idea that a landscape that's not a lawn can evolve over the years and can grow more mature and more complex. And I really think that's when we bond with the landscape. It's when it becomes more complex and when we tie ourselves to its changes and we note its different seasonalities, and we really can get into it. The lawn, I don't know of many people who are really, they might admire their lawn and how green it is, and they might use it once in a while, but mm-hmm. I don't know of any that have the same love for it that people have for other kinds of landscapes.
No, I think that's true. I think it's a sense of accomplishment. Like, I think it's, like having a clean, the people that are out there cleaning their, washing their car and then mowing their green grass, it's just that sense of accomplishment.
Yeah.
But yet you go, they would spend a few minutes admiring it and then they go back in the house kind of thing. So,
But the people who have the other kinds of landscapes, this is one thing to me, is it changes your whole lifestyle. It changes the way you can live in your place that you're living in. Mm-hmm. It changes the views from all your windows. It changes the comfort you feel when you're spending time outdoors, and it changes the things that you can do out there. Like, I can wander through my garden, and one of my favorite things to do is graze. I pick things and I eat them, And another favorite thing is watching the bugs, and the hummingbirds here are great. So just seeing what else is out there living and watching it is fascinating.
Yeah. And I think the big thing you see if you agree with me, I think is the maintenance part of it. I think, maybe the first couple of years, it's a bit more maintenance, right? To get it going and waiting for the plants to fill in and making sure you've picked the right plants. But once it gets established, unlike a lawn that needs constant, water, fertilizing, cutting, that type of thing, I think the gardens do kind of just take care of themselves, right? So you have more free time versus,
I don't know.
No, you don't know?
I have to say it depends.
Okay.
It depends. Now, there's several points about the gardens. I think the maintenance changes, certainly, and you don't get that weekly demand of, I better go out and pay attention to the lawn because it needs water, it needs fertilizer, it needs mowing, it needs edging, whatever.
Yeah.
But you do get maybe more concerted effort would be required maybe in the spring and the fall, or, you get a couple of points during the year at which you would maybe go out there and spend a little more time and do a little more. Like if you have sort of a prairie-ish planting, a mix of grasses and flowers, you might go out there in the early spring, say March in Ontario or February, and cut it all down.
Yeah.
And that would be most of your maintenance. But it depends. It depends on what you try to grow out there.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'd advocate for people trying to grow things that can just kind of all take over that little area and happily fill it. So I generally tell people this is a place to put your plants that if it's edged by the road and the sidewalk already, it's got a nice robust edge that can withstand creeping plants that you wouldn't necessarily be able to put in with the rest of your plants. Maybe maybe that's the only place you can grow mint some of those other spreaders that you might like. Mm-hmm. It might be kind of nice to have them. And they fill up the bed for you, and then they keep out the weeds.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that's it does depend what you put out there. But if you try and put some stuff out there that's going to, get trampled or is going to sort of fall over because it's such a skinny little bed, and the plant doesn't stay upright, then you're going to maybe create other work for yourself.
Yeah.
So it's all about designing away those kinds of extra work that could come if you chose the plants
properly.
That would make it happen.
Okay. No, I agree. I think it does come back down to the design. And I know if I'm going to help clients and help listeners design them, then I need to do some of my own research, I guess. And so it's going to be good for me to do that, my experiment on my my house strip. And the challenge, though, also is that it is because of the curve, it might only be 3 feet wide, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. The circumference is pretty big. So I could just see my husband's face when I order the mulch to arrive. but we'll give it a shot. We'll give it a shot.
Yeah, good. That's good.
Yeah.
That's all you can do.
Exactly.
And I tell people, look around at what else is growing in your neighborhood, what else is growing in your yard, and use divisions of those things and seedlings of those things. And, be more okay with commonly used plants than you might be otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we get to be a little snobby about, I don't want more of that, you know.
Right.
And another thing I would say is they try some herbs. I think a lot of herbs are really tough and can adapt to a lot of different conditions. And many of them grow in really nice rounded shapes
or
well-contained shapes.
Yeah.
So, you've got your lavenders and garden sage and thyme. And,
chives.
Those things.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, chives is really good. So those are good. And then one other thing is just maybe include what I call ambassador plants. I think it's important if you're in a neighborhood that doesn't have a lot of other gardens out there on the health strip that people understand that it's a garden. And one bridge you can build for them is to put something familiar out there, along with all your other native plants or whatever you're putting out there that's tough, put, some bearded iris or some purple coneflower or something that they will say, I love that plant. And then they'll maybe be more likely to think of the other plants as interesting and even if they're just mainly chosen for toughness.
Right. Okay. No, that's a good point. So given that we can do this in any zone, my next question I know is going to be a tough one for you in that I was going to ask you some of your plant recommendations, but I know that's challenging, right? Because from coast to coast, that's going to vary.
Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't pick the same plants for every climate for sure, but there are a lot of plants that really grow well in many parts of the country, and I guess those would be some good choices to start with, other than the ones that we've already talked about.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, and it depends on whether you have sun or shade.
Right.
But I guess some of the common ones that might be easy starts would be some of the ornamental grasses, whatever ornamental grasses grow well in your area that aren't too large. Those are really nice because even if they grow taller than some of the other plants, they might be airy and easy to look through, and they feel friendly. They're nice to touch. So those are kind of good ones, and they add movement. They're maybe going to be out there exposed to a breeze, so something that moves like that is nice, or maybe the sun will hit them just right, and those heads will glow. So those are good starts. Something like lamb's ears that has really fuzzy leaves is always a good one, too. Real friendly, totally hardy and easy to grow. And, even the kids will like petting it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in the shade, maybe things like lilies of the valley, hostas, pansies, wild geraniums, foxgloves, those are just beautiful, hardy plants that have sort of followed people along for hundreds, if not thousands of years. So stuff like that, and stay away from the poisonous plants, like castor bean and
right.
monk's hood, and
yes.
The ones that are going to have thorns are going to, you know, smack people in the face as
yeah.
they walk by, or drop large nuts on them.
Yes,
stuff like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, barberry's good. Yeah, barberry's good for that kind of area in the sense that it loves it tough, but then they are prickly. And then I find they're a great litter catcher, though, too, so that everything that, you know, blows down the street gets caught in your lovely barberry. So, yeah, that can be God, that can be one
that
to rethink.
Good or bad, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess.
Depending on how often you clean your barberry.
Yes.
One that I really like is blanket flower, and that grows really well in many parts of the country.
Mm, okay.
And Coreopsis is another one. There's so many varieties of it, but
yeah.
those two seem really tough for sunny areas. And they flower, and they have nice, big, bright flowers that people like.
Yeah. I was thinking about catmint. I wonder about catmint.
Oh,
Nepeta.
I love it.
Yeah.
Love it. That's another good one that would just do well almost anywhere.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, poppies are pretty drought-tolerant and shade-tolerant and all sorts of other things. And I've seen a lot of health strips that have poppies, both the kind that sort of... the somniferum ones that grow straight up and get kind of tall, and then you would maybe pull them out
okay.
after they self-sow, and the ornamental ones that are the oriental ones
oh,
that
okay.
are lower and have the big red flowers.
Yeah.
So I've seen a lot of those, and they do really well on those places.
They're and they're very tap rooted too. The oriental ones.
Yeah,
I know. I have a clump.
Be.
Yeah.
Why?
You can't divide those or relocate those because they're so tap rooted. So they would really...
But then they stay more drought tolerant
yeah.
because of that.
Yeah,
so, yeah,
for sure. So they would really
yeah.
be a lower maintenance plant. Wow, our time
and
is
another
fine.
One that I'm growing now is white gaura. That's a really nice one. I don't know if you guys grow that there.
Here more as an annual, unfortunately. It doesn't seem to make...
Oh,
they do sell. They sometimes do sell it as a perennial, but it doesn't often. From my years of working at the nursery, it doesn't often make it through the winter, unfortunately. But
and it doesn't self-sow probably
no,
either then.
No, it doesn't. So.
And the blue flax now is another one that I grew in Minnesota that it would endure the winters and it would self-sow a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Stay pretty low, but it's got a nice flower that can re-bloom
mm-hmm.
in the fall when it gets cooler, which
yeah.
is, it's awful nice to think about stuff, you know, trying to create a garden that is interesting in many seasons,
right.
even in a small space like
mm-hmm.
that. Maybe especially in a small space
yeah.
like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So what are some of the common, I can't believe time's flying fast here, common
I
mistakes?
Know.
Like, so, you know, have you seen people try this? Or is there some words of advice or some?
Yeah, I'd say one of the biggest mistakes people make is just, it's probably many of the mistakes people make, meaning that they create a garden that then it requires more work
mm-hmm.
or doesn't make them happy,
mm-hmm.
Is it they treat that garden like the rest of their garden when it's
okay.
really not. It's a different kind of site, and it has different considerations. So I'd say if you can pay attention to things like do people need to walk across this? Do people need
mm-hmm.
to open their car doors? Do the utility companies need to get in here every once in a while? Are things going to hang over the sidewalk and impede people's progress, et cetera? Are dogs going to be able to trample this easily?
Mm-hmm.
If you can pay attention to that and sort of work around all those things and keep them in mind, you're less likely to make most of the mistakes that that would lead to being unhappy with your garden. And I think also, you know, not spending too many resources on it, but really trying to make it more self-sustaining, you know, getting out of the mode of I'm going to be the gardener who cares for my plants and pampers them and gives them what they need,
mm-hmm.
be more about this is nature and I'm going to unleash nature in this site and let it go
mm-hmm.
Wild and let it really become healthy and stay healthy on its own because I'm going to pick the right plants in the right community that can do that. You know,
okay.
that's I think what it is all about is having a little bit of a different mindset when you approach this kind of a garden.
Right. Okay, that's a great advice. I think that is wonderful advice. Thank you. I think that sums it up.
Fun talking.
Yeah. So do you have any, I mean, you've written two books in a few years, and you've written more before that. So are you working, is there anything you'd like to share with us or that you can talk about? I know sometimes it's a secret.
I'm mostly, what I'm doing now is I'm really throwing a lot of energy into creating my new garden. Mm. I am writing, but I'm writing every month I'm posting at Garden Rant, which is that teen blog that's out there with several different voices, and I'm one of them.
Excellent.
So that is mainly what I'm doing as far as the gardening writing goes, and then I'm pouring some more energy into songwriting at this point.
Oh, neat.
So I've sort of, but I still have, I'm still thinking and have many ideas for writing in the future, but nothing to share right now.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay.
As far as gardening goes.
Yeah, no, I do highly recommend. I mean, the book is, I think it's, you've done a wonderful job at it being a beautiful book. The pictures are beautiful. The layout is beautiful, but also it's very instructional. Like, I really like that.
I'm glad.
I'm kind of a geeky that way, so I'm not sure if everybody, mm-hmm. but I think that's, you've really accomplished that. And I love your create a paradise between the sidewalk and the curb. So I think that's,
well, thank you.
That was
great. I think I do really appeal to thoughtful gardeners. If you want something that just says, here's how you do it, and don't bother to try to ask any questions or consider all different ways, then I'm probably not the writer for you. But if you want to learn about all the potential pitfalls and all these different aspects to consider and not have somebody necessarily tell you what to do, then mm-hmm. I'm more of that approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's good. I think it's going to be good for me because it's been something I've been wanting to do, and I've been a bit chicken. I mean, it's, cut myself some slack in the sense that because I do what I do for a living, time in my own garden is a little bit challenging, right? So, and that's why I'm thinking, okay, if I did it this fall when I'm not as busy, and then if it's not ready mm-hmm. to plant first thing in the spring, that's okay, because that's when I'm busy.
You'll
and if
busy.
It, you know,
yeah.
it would be okay until I got to it, later spring or beginning of summer type of thing. So that's, kind of giving me
like
hope.
An experiment.
Yeah.
And it's a place where you can just learn. And then, of course, that's what you'll need to do in order to make the gardens for your clients. They know you have all different considerations about that, and you'll want to understand what succeeds before you maybe put theirs in, not experiment as much, but in your own property, for sure, you can play and just see what grows and what doesn't and all that.
No, I'm looking forward to that because I think that I often try, when they come out with a new hydrangea or a new plant, I tend to kind of tuck one or two in my garden just see, is it true? And is it as good as they say? And then mm-hmm. before I use them in my designs,
that would be a really great test of any plant, I think, is putting it in a health strip.
Absolutely.
Well, if it succeeds there, it'll succeed anywhere.
I think it's a great alternative. And I think the more we talk about health strips and the more we make people and even the less lawn, doing the no-mow and really promoting that. I found the website very practical. I was clicking on all the little different terms, and it's very mm-hmm. instructional. So I definitely, I think that, I hope that's going well. Is that, how are you finding the reception?
Oh, it gets a lot of hits. I have not revamped it in a while, and I need to get out there and add more to it, but it's already got a lot there, and I'm happy to leave it there and have it be sort of a place for people to discover all the different things you can do besides have a lawn, and maybe sort of an intro to how you might go about figuring out what else you could have,
mm-hmm.
which is what the other book, Beautiful No Mow Yards, is about too. I like to present all those possibilities because there are so many, from patios and ponds to forests to prairie gardens to rain gardens. It's all just so much is possible instead of lawn.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. We had a guest on just a couple weeks ago. Sean James was in Ontario as a well-known speaker regarding and designer and installer of Rain Gardens. So we learned, my listeners and I learned lots more about that too. And it's great as a designer, you know, always wanting to learn. There's always so much to learn. And
and it's
the best
and
way.
Rain Gardens are exciting.
Yeah. And it's the best way for me to get the word out to clients, right? And kind of spread the spread it. So
No, I really appreciate that you're spreading these ideas to people who maybe haven't stumbled upon them otherwise. You know, how do we learn? We learn by just seeing the gardens that we're maybe walking past or driving past, but or reading books or listening to the radio or finding websites like yours. Or we learn by, you know, hiring a designer and having that designer sort of coach us through things and help us figure out what we could do and maybe save us a lot of mistakes.
Oh, for sure. For sure, yeah. I mean, it really is the low maintenance is the right plant in the right spot, really. Because if it's happy there, you know.
Yeah, if it's happy there and if it's been chosen to fit the space and, you know, if the maintenance that you do for it doesn't, you know, cause it to grow out of bounds or, you know, give it too much of a good thing, yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, I thank you very much. I know our listeners can find you on Garden Rant. So it's gardenrant.com. Is that correct?
Yes. And if they want me personally, it's evelynhedden.com or leslon.com is where they can find all those articles you were talking about. So I'm out there.
Excellent. And you're on Twitter?
Twitter, I'm not very good at it.
That's okay.
I'm just a newbie bird or whatever they call it.
Baby bird, maybe. Are you a baby bird?
A baby bird.
There you go. Yeah. But that's okay. Yeah, we can still find you. And people have further questions and stuff, you're at leslon, right? At leslon, I think, is your tag.
Evelyn at leslon.com.
Excellent.
That's right.
Well, thank you very much for joining me tonight. And I learned a lot, and I've been taking notes, and I'm going to continue to cherish your book, and I'll keep you posted on how I do with my health strip. So.
Yes, I would love to hear more about that, Joanne, and it was a real pleasure to talk to you.
Yes.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome, and I hope we connect at another Garden Bloggers Fling at some point. So
yes, that would be great. I'll look forward to it.
Yes, wonderful. Well, thank you very much, Evelyn. You have a lovely night.
You too, and happy gardening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, there you have it, everyone. I hope you enjoyed and learned a lot about that tough area of your yard. And you know, that boulevard is kind of tough, right?
It is tough. And a lot of people, they don't know if they should do anything with it. That's the problem all the time, because you always hear the argument, well, we don't own that.
Yes.
That's the city's, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's so rare. I mean, it does happen that the city has to, you know, dig it up and do something there. But I think that's so rare.
It is
that,
rare.
Compared to the amount of money you're putting on water and fertilizer and stuff. So
I agree.
So, I think it's I think that term is kind of a fun term. And I know the gardens we did see in Minneapolis were gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, they weren't babied at all. So
let nature
I think,
take its course.
Yeah, for sure. So I hope that gives some of you hope for something that you can do with a challenging area of your garden. Please follow me on downtoearth.ca. The number 2 is my website. I'm going to start blogging a bit about it and post pictures of my health strip on my website.
I can't wait to see that.
Yeah, so you can follow along and see how I do in my journey. So
that'd be great.
We'll see how that turns out, and then that way I can help others. So I think that's a great way to spread the word.
And I would just like to say at this time, I hope you and your husband have a wonderful cruise.
Thank you.
Look at all the plants that are on the ship.
Yes. Yep,
there's a lot of hanging baskets.
That'll be good.
That's right.
We will have an encore presentation next week.
Yes.
But the week after that, we are talking veggies. We're going back to the vegetables.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. So Jennifer White will be joining me in studio to talk. She's an urban farmer here in Oshawa. Mm-hmm. And her whole backyard, talk about health strip there. She's got a veggie strip. So she's going to talk about her growing her vegetables and selling them to the city and or to everybody who wants them. So
very nice.
Anyway, so yeah, and looking forward to more great shows in October. So I wanted to thank everybody once again for joining me down the garden path here on Reality Radio 101.
Thank you for listening to Down the Garden Path with your host, Joanne Shaw, right here on Reality Radio 101.